Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Police in Kenya say men arrested were planning an attack, and Zuma is told to repay part of the $23 million home makeover. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. Kenyan police have arrested two men they say had explosives that were to be used in an attack. Police said the men were of Somali origin, and Mombasa police said they suspect the men are linked to the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The vehicle the two were driving was seized near the city of Mombasa. Police found heavy explosives and automatic weapons concealed inside. South Africa's top anti-corruption official has accused President Jacob Zuma of misconduct for accepting a state-funded $23 million upgrade to his home. The report from the public protector Thuli Mendoncella says the president should repay some of the cost for the makeover of his compound. The upgrade, which the government said was done for security reasons, included the installation of a swimming pool, cattle corral, and an amphitheater. Mendoncella says the president never objected to the spending. The report was released today, 6 weeks before South Africa holds national elections. Pro-Russian forces have taken control of Ukraine's Navy headquarters in the Crimean port of Sevastopol. It comes a day after Russia signed a treaty with local authorities to make Crimea part of Russia. Witnesses say at least 200 unarmed self-defense forces entered the base today and raised the Russian flag. Ukrainian service members did not resist the takeover and were seen leaving the facility. Russian news agencies quoted sources in the Sevastopol's prosecutor's office as saying the commander of Ukraine's Navy had been temporarily detained after leaving the Navy headquarters. The majority Russian region voted in a referendum on Sunday to break away from Ukraine and join Russia. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop says that referendum is not legitimate.
The actions taken by Russia are a clear violation of international rules prohibiting the use of force and protecting the territorial integrity of states. International law does not allow one state to steal the territory of another on the basis of a referendum that cannot be considered free or fair.
You can read more details on this story at voanews.com. Frustration over the lack of progress in the search for a missing Malaysia Airlines jet erupted today at a daily news conference where Chinese relatives of missing passengers confronted Malaysian officials. The grieving families burst into the room where the media briefing was to be held, yelling and holding a banner demanding Malaysia tell the truth about what happened to the plane that has been missing since March 8th. One unidentified woman directed her frustration at a Malaysian Airlines official. Two-thirds of the plane's 227 passengers were Chinese. Many of their families have become increasingly angry about what they feel is contradictory or confusing information released by Malaysia. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama arrives in China Thursday for a six-day visit along with her daughters and her mother. Bill Lyne has more.
Even before Ms. Obama arrived in Beijing, Chinese state media reports were emphasizing the visit, calling it a sequel to last year's informal get-together in Sunnylands, California, between President Barack Obama and China's Xi Jinping. The first day of her trip will be spent with her Chinese counterpart in Beijing, Mr. Xi's wife and First Lady Peng Liyuan. The two will visit a school and the Forbidden City. They will also attend a performance after dinner. The capital's popular Beijing News talked about how First Lady diplomacy could play a unique role in U.S.-China relations. Bill Ide, Beijing.
Hundreds of protesters have burst into Taiwan's legislature to demand the government scrap a trade deal with China. The protesters knocked down a large metal gate as they entered the legislative chamber late Tuesday and were using chairs to keep the police out. They are protesting a trade deal with China they say will endanger Taiwanese jobs and increase Beijing's growing influence. Israeli airstrikes against Syrian military positions in the Golan Heights killed one soldier and wounded seven in the most serious escalation between the two neighbors since Syria's civil war broke out 3 years ago. Both sides issued stark warnings after the incidents. More at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns that drug-resistant tuberculosis has become a global threat. It says despite the growing number of cases, there are no effective treatments.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, police and protesters clashed today at Cairo universities. Members of a recently suspended political party in Burundi could receive life sentences for a political protest that turned violent earlier this month. And Italian naval authorities have rescued more than 2,000 immigrants off the south coast of Sicily in the last 2 days. We'll have these stories, plus sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga, music, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Al Haram, the semi-official Egyptian government newspaper, says clashes broke out today between students and police at Cairo universities. The violence was reported on at least 5 campuses. The health ministry reported the death of a 13-year-old demonstrator at the Beni Siouf campus. Students claimed at least one additional but unconfirmed death and several injuries at Beni Siouf. Police also fired tear gas to prevent marchers at Cairo University from nearing the Giza Security Directorate. Dozens of students have been arrested at many locations where they formed human chains that were quickly broken up by police. The National Alliance to Support Legitimacy called for nationwide demonstrations today to denounce what they called a military coup against the former president Mohamed Morsi. Also in Egypt, 2 Egyptian army bomb disposal experts died today during an early morning raid on a suspected bomb factory outside of Cairo. An interior ministry spokesman says militants of the Ansar Beit al-Maqdis were inside a timber warehouse in a Nile Delta town 19 miles north of Cairo. The militants began a 4-hour firefight with police and special forces units and detonated car bombs during the gun battle. Ansar Beit al-Maqdis is believed linked to many of the terrorist bomb attacks in the Sinai and more recent attacks close to Cairo. 5 militants and 6 members of the Egyptian security force were killed. The 2 explosives experts were a brigadier general and a colonel. Italian naval authorities have rescued more than 2,000 immigrants off the south coast of Sicily in the last 2 days. The high number includes nearly 600 picked up on the Mediterranean on Monday. 3 merchant ships aided Italy's task force in the latest rescue operation. Italy has for decades rescued thousands of African refugees in overcrowded and unsafe boats sailing to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Those numbers have escalated since the 2011 Arab Spring revolutions in North Africa. Hundreds have drowned in the Mediterranean in failed attempts to reach Europe. The European Union Border Agency says more than 20,000 have entered Europe illegally through Lampedusa and other Sicilian ports in the last 4 months of 2013. More attempts by sea are expected as better sailing weather nears. Nine minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns that drug-resistant tuberculosis has become a global threat. It says despite the growing number of cases, there are no effective treatments. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Doctors Without Borders has released a crisis alert called the new face of an old disease. The group, also known by the French acronym MSF, says urgent action is needed to solve the problem. Dr. Philip Ducrot is a TB advisor for MSF.
In MSF's experience, we're seeing MDR-TB, or multi-drug-resistant TB, in more and more countries and in more numbers in our programs.
There are about 500,000 new cases of MDR-TB every year. Ducrot says it's hard enough dealing with MDR-TB, let alone an even stronger strain of the bacteria that causes XDR-TB, or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. He tells the story of an infected child in Central Asia.
After a year of treatment, she was failing treatment with all the drugs that we have. So this poor child had gone through treatment where she had suffered from nausea almost every day, and she was going deaf from one of the drugs. She was having to take over 7 different drugs every day, all with different side effects. And despite trying to take all of this treatment, she was failing treatment and showing the limits of the treatment that we have available currently.
Standard TB drugs do not work against the new forms of the disease. Treatment for MDR-TB could last 2 years, during which time a patient may swallow 10,000 pills and have daily injections for 8 months. And after all that, it may not work.
I think the main reason this has got to be a big problem is that although we've made some progress tackling TB, in recent years the global community has turned away from investing in improving on what we can do with TB. We've been satisfied with old answers. The reality is that we don't have currently the answers that will solve the problem of TB. We don't have actually effective treatments in new regimens that will actually tackle the large epidemic of multidrug-resistant TB.
Ducrot says bacteria can build resistance when TB patients fail to complete their drug regimen and when countries do not strictly control the use of medications.
It's a global problem which the global community needs to take responsibility for. Not just international organizations like our own or the World Health Organization, but I think also governments and pharmaceutical companies and academics. There are maybe lots of good individual initiatives, but I think as a global community, we really need to come together urgently and look at how we can have faster solutions that are going to deliver a real change at ground level for this epidemic.
The solution, he says, is a much shorter, more effective treatment. Currently, there are only about 5 to 8 drugs used to treat resistant TB, depending on the regimen needed. The 2 latest drugs available are actually the first new TB medications developed in 40 years.
Although that's cause for optimism, we still don't know how to use those drugs in new regimens, and so we're limited by adding them to a regimen that is already highly toxic and difficult for patients to take.
Dr. Ducrot says if a global investment is not made to address the epidemic, there will be a price to pay.
As an example, in the United States in the early 90s, there was an outbreak of multidrug-resistant TB. And as a result of a few hundred cases, the public health program invested nearly $1 billion US. That number of patients is not even a third of what we see in one of our programs in one country. If we don't start to step in early to deal with the problem now, you can multiply that figure by a huge number that you can pluck out of the air.
Doctors Without Borders says with only 1 in 5 people in need receiving treatment, the fatal airborne disease is left to spread indiscriminately. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Human Rights Watch says the government of Senegal needs to do more to crack down on so-called Quranic schools that abuse young boys and force them to beg on the streets for food and spare change. The forced begging has been a problem for years in Senegal, and the government has pledged to eliminate it by 2015. But HRW says little progress has been made. Jennifer Lazuta has more from Dakar.
You don't have to go far on the streets of Dakar before being approached by barefoot young boys in tattered t-shirts asking for money or food. The boys, known as Talibay, can be as young as 4 years old. They ask for 100 seifa, or about 20 cents. They hold out empty tomato cans to collect coins and food. They need to meet their daily quota or face serious consequences. Matt Wells, a West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch, explains.
Each day, tens of thousands of boys across the country are sent out onto the streets to beg. They generally have to bring back a set amount of money, uncooked rice and sugar, that's handed over to the Quranic teacher, And when they fail to bring back that amount of money, they're often beaten quite brutally.
Wells has studied the Taliban in Senegal since 2010 and has written several reports on the topic. He says the boys often live in overcrowded, unsanitary rooms. They go hungry and receive very little actual education, religious or otherwise. Not all Krang schools in Senegal, known as daras, engage in such exploitation and abuse. However, a government survey this year found that of the nearly 55,000 children enrolled in Quranic schools in Dakar, more than 30,000 currently practice begging. The problem is not new in Senegal, but activists say authorities have been slow to do anything about it. Laws that forbid forced begging are rarely enforced. However, on the streets of Dakar, public opinion is slowly changing.
Franchement, c'est pas une bonne initiative là. Il faut d'abord trouver une solution pour les enfants.
36-year-old Abdoulaye Badji says we need to find a solution for these children because to leave them out in the streets like that, it's truly not good. These boys, they have no future, he says. They need better housing, for example, but the government is busy with other things. At the very least, they could recruit better teachers. There have been several high-profile cases of abuse in recent years. In March 2013, 8 Taliban died in a fire in Dakar. Their teacher had locked them in the school building where they were living. Neighbors said they knew the man was locking the children inside the school. In the aftermath of the deadly fire, the government once again pledged to crack down on child begging and to better regulate Quranic schools. But it's been 1 year and HRW says the state has only shut down one Quranic school for safety reasons. HRW says there are hundreds more that can be easily identified as violating the rights of their students. Senegal's Ministry of Justice says it is aware of the Taliban problem and is working on new legislation. Awa Ndour, a representative for the Ministry of Justice's Task Force Against Human Trafficking, says the fight against child begging is a process that involves many different actors, not just the government. We are working to pass a new law to regulate Quranic schools and also to ensure the 2005 law is applied, she says. But there is a lot of cultural resistance to such laws in Senegal. There is often lobbying by religious groups. So authorities must fight this resistance to fight child begging. HRW's Wells says a law dealing specifically with the regulation of Quranic schools would be a step in the right direction. But, he adds, the government would then have to enforce the new regulations. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, members of a recently suspended political party in Burundi could receive life sentences for a political protest that turned violent earlier this month. The case highlights growing political tensions in the country ahead of next year's presidential election. VOA's East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports.
On March 8th, demonstrators from the opposition Movement for Solidarity and Democracy, MSD, took to the streets of Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, to protest against what they saw as the government's restrictions on political freedoms. They were met by riot police, who fired tear gas to break up the protest. More than a dozen opposition members were injured during clashes that followed, while two policemen were briefly held hostage at MSD headquarters. Now, the party has been suspended for 4 months, and 46 party members are on trial, facing the possibility of life in prison on charges of insurrection, violence against police, and rebellion. Another 22 are facing lesser charges. The president of the Forum for Strengthening Civil Society in Burundi, Vital Nshimirimana, says the March 8th crackdown was politically guided.
The police shows that it is not neutral. It is not neutral in the sense that it is a kind of led by some thought of the ruling party.
Presidential adviser Gervais Abayehu denies there is any deliberate crackdown on the opposition. He tells VOA the protesters violated an order by the interior minister that banned political rallies on that particular day, which coincided with a public celebration of International Women's Day.
Things in this country are such that if you do not go by the law, if you do not respect what the interior minister is saying or the government is saying, it does not matter whether you are in opposition or whether you are in the ruling party, you have to face the full force of the law.
The recent violence has grabbed the attention of the international community. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement after the clashes, urging both sides to show restraint while deploring the growing restrictions on the freedom of expression, association, and assembly in Burundi. The U.S. State Department condemned the government's use of heavy-handed tactics to break up the rally. Abayehu says the overall political atmosphere is not as bad as it is made out to be, noting that the government has set up forums to discuss issues of concern among political parties. He says the international community should not rely on information it gets from the opposition.
If the international community rely on what is really the reality in the country, I think there is no reason, there is no cause for concern in this country. We see the country being stable, being peaceful.
Some activists believe the government is intentionally stifling the opposition in order to place the ruling party in a stronger position ahead of next year's presidential and parliamentary elections. The opposition boycotted the last vote in 2010 because of concerns of vote rigging, giving an easy victory to President Pierre Nkurunziza. Jean-Claude Nkundwa, a Burundian peace activist living in the United States, has concerns about the next vote given the current political conditions.
There is a need of support on this election process that is coming to ensure that it's fair and transparent. And it will not be fair and transparent if the democratic principles are not respected.
Nkundwa is a survivor of the ethnic conflict that took place in Burundi more than 20 years ago, along the same Hutu-Tutsi lines as the genocide in neighboring Rwanda. Since then, political reforms helped promote reconciliation in the country. But now, Nkundwa says he fears Burundi is sliding backwards.
It's getting dangerous because the frustration always has been the cause of war. If people feel their needs of justice are not met, and people try to express themselves and they crack down, and then at the end there is explosion.
Civil society groups are also concerned about constitutional changes proposed by the ruling party that would reduce the powers of the vice president, among other changes to the existing balance of power. Activists have accused the ruling party of trying to change the laws to allow a third term for President Nkurunziza. The government strongly denies the allegation and says the proposed changes will put the country more in line with the political systems of its East African neighbors. Gabe Josselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Malawi President Joyce Banda is facing pressure to reveal documents related to proceeds from the sale of a presidential jet to British Virgin Islands company Bonok Enterprises. The money from the $15 million transaction was to be used to buy maize and medicines for the country. Reports, however, are surfacing that the money is either missing or has been used to offset a military arms debt. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Malawians started to ask about the money after a local newspaper recently published a story on the issue. The story quoted sources in the Treasury as saying they could not trace how the funds were used because they were not deposited into the government's consolidated account, known as account number one. Several government authorities say the money was used for its intended purpose. President Joyce Banda maintained her earlier stance during a recent press conference in the capital, Lilongwe. She says although she was the one who instructed the sale of the jet, but she did not do it alone. She says she presented the issue before the cabinet meeting where it was agreed that they should use the money for buying maize. She says they also agreed to buy military equipment for the peacekeeping mission in the DRC, buying medicine and contributing to the farm input subsidy program. When pressed on the matter, Finance Minister Maxwell Nkwezalamba said the money did not really go into the treasury, but was used to offset a military arms debt, which the government owed to the private defense firm Paramount Group, whose subsidiary is Bonox.
Instead of them giving us the $50 million for the presidential jet, we requested Bonox, given their association with Paramount, to basically pay Paramount, that amount. So, that money never came.
Information Minister Brown Mpinganjira previously told reporters that the money was used to buy maize and military equipment, and that some of it was used to finance the farm input subsidy program. The contradictions have raised suspicion among members of the general public, including the NGOs and opposition politicians who think the money may have been embezzled. Legal experts have also argued that by battling, the government contravened Section 172 of the Malawi Constitution, which does not allow expenditures of government revenue before it is deposited in the consolidated account. Jessica Bwira is the spokesperson for the leading opposition party in Parliament, Malawi Congress Party. She says the component of trading off does not hold water because the Public Finance Management Act does not allow barter as a form of trade. She says that for claims of funding the United Nations peacekeeping mission to be viable, the government should produce an invoice claiming the refund of the money from the UN and another transaction from the UN acknowledging the same to the Malawi government. A local rights NGO, Malawi Watch, has written the Attorney General and the Minister of Information demanding the government supply documents and other proof relating to how the jet proceeds were utilized. Billy Banda is its executive director.
Malawians are being given contradictory information, and it is more like we are giving much room to various stakeholders, including opposition, to take advantage and build a mountain on the same. And owing to that, we thought it would be much prudent to demand or to request the Office of Minister of Information and the Attorney General to provide a transaction that I think followed the procurement of drugs, the procurement of ammunition for the peacekeeping, and the procurement of meals.
Nkwesa Lamba said it is doubtful the government can produce any information pertaining to the sale of the jet.
We've been very open and transparent in terms of how this transaction was conducted. I'm a bit surprised that even with this all detailed information, you still think that there is need for more to be given. The documentation would be there. Then can we share it with you? Some of the documentation, I doubt it.
Defense Minister Kenny Kanodo told a local daily, The Nation, that the government cannot release documents concerning the purchase of the military equipment because they are classified. Representatives of the NGOs under the Grand Coalition for the Defense of Democracy and Constitution are threatening to hold a nationwide demonstration should the government fail to produce documents on the use of the proceeds from the jet sale. The group petitioned President Banda following demonstrations in Blantyre last month. Among other issues, the petition calls for an immediate meeting of Parliament to deliberate findings on the preliminary forensic audit report and the sale of the jet. President Banda has yet to respond to their petition, although a 14-day ultimatum elapsed a week ago. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
It's 28 minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Doctors Without Borders warns that drug-resistant tuberculosis has become a global concern, and members of a recently suspended political party in Burundi could receive life sentences for a political protest that turned violent earlier this month. Coming up, we'll have some music and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, time now for sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Impuga sitting in today for Sonny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Kim, we're starting off with women's soccer. Thank you. At the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup, Costa Rica 2014, Ghana took top spot in Group B and earned a place in the quarterfinals after beating Germany. In Group A, Italy and Venezuela booked their tickets to the knockout phase with victories over Costa Rica and Zambia, respectively. That means Costa Rica and Zambia are eliminated from the tournament. The two have yet to score a goal in two World Cup matches so far. However, Costa Rica will still play a final Group A match against Zambia on Saturday at the National Stadium in Western San Jose. The host team will just be playing for pride at that point. In Group B, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Canada and Germany are still in contention for a place in the last eight. Other matches lined up for Wednesday are in Group C, New Zealand plays Spain, Paraguay plays Japan, and in Group D, Mexico play China, Colombia play Nigeria. Still in football, African football players have been scoring goals recently all across Europe. Our African football guru, David Legg, told VOA's Sonny Young that in the English Premier League, a Nigerian striker had a big game over the weekend.
Peter Obdamwingi, who plays for Stoke City, was one of the headline stealers at the weekend. He scored not once, but twice in a 3-1 home victory over West Ham United. One goal was a deflection, but the other a superb first-time shot. And that's nice to see Obdamwingi, who's been a little bit unsettled of late, a bit nomadic. He was with West Bromwich, and then he had a short spell at Cardiff City, and then he moved to Stoke. But he now appears to be finding his feet there. Talking of West Brom, Sonny, they won 2-1 at Swansea in a crucial game in the relegation end of the table. And both the West Bromwich goals came from Africans. The equaliser came from Stefan Sessegnon, a player from Benin, and then Yusuf Malumbu from the Democratic Republic of Congo scored a very good winning goal. Another player that's doing very well, and he's a name we've mentioned many times on Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Yusuf El Arabi, who plays for the Spanish La Liga side, Granada. He's a Moroccan international, born in France, but of Moroccan parents. And he scored twice for Granada against Getafe in a 3-3 draw. And not satisfied with that, he also assisted in the other Granada goal. And that takes his tally for the season to 11 goals. And that's really good going for El Arabi. And not the easiest of leagues to score in, the Spanish La Liga. I know a lot of people think the English Premier League is the top league in the world. But in terms of tactics and technique, I don't think it's a match for the Spanish La Liga. If we switch to Italy...
Hi, I'm Michael Essien, midfielder.
Michael Essien, the Ghanaian, no goals from him, but he must be the saddest African story of the weekend when it comes to our footballers in Europe. He was on the field for just 4 minutes playing for AC Milan when he had to be substituted. And the reason was the AC Milan goalkeeper, were sent off, they had to bring on a reserve goalkeeper, and that meant that an outfield player had to be sacrificed. And the sacrificial lamb was Michael Essien. Not very often that happens, Sonny. You go on the field, and 4 minutes later, you're on the bench for the rest of the game. Another interesting story from Italy concerning an African, and this time it's Ibrahima Mbaye, who plays for the lowly Livorno. He's a Senegalese defender. Now, last week, he scored twice, but his team lost 4-2. And the roles reversed to some extent this week, in that he was sent off late in the second half for a second bookable offense, but his team still held on for a 2-1 win over Bologna. So two goals last week, but defeat, and this week a red card, but victory. So it seems like Ibrahima Mbaye has ups and downs every time he turns out. In Germany, Joupo Mutting, the Cameroonian striker, he netted for the third consecutive week for Mainz. They came from two goals down to beat Hoffenheim 4-2. So a really consistent scorer. And that's good news, Sonny, for Cameroon, looking ahead to the World Cup because he's part of the national squad. If we move now to France, and another Ghanaian on target, Abdul Majid Waris. He scored Valenciennes' only goal in a 1-0 victory over Evian. Also, Sonny, we're off to Russia. And there, the Gabonese midfielder, Gaylor Kanga, scored for Rostov in an away victory in the Russian Premier League. So, good news, really. Africans scoring goals all over Europe.
That was our African football guru, David Legg. Thank you.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Kikwete.
United, we can beat malaria.
The Voice of America, VOA. Yes, this is the Sunny Side of Sports coming to you live from Washington. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Marco Ouma.
In Benin, Frenchman Didier Ole-Nicole is the new coach for the Benin national team, the Benin Football Federation disclosing Cotonou on Tuesday. His first order of business is to guide Benin in the qualifiers for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Turning to handball, defending champions Egypt play Tunisia as Angola and Algeria face off in the semifinals of the Africa Boys Youth Handball Championships in Nairobi, Kenya today, Wednesday. Kenya play Libya as Zambia face Niger in classification matches. The contest is a qualifier for the World Youth Olympics in Nanjing, China in August. Angola already qualified for Nanjing in the girls' event in Oyo, Congo-Brazzaville last year. Meanwhile, 24 teams have converged in Mahdia, a coastal town 225 kilometers southeast of the Tunisian capital Tunis, for the Arab Club Handball Championships starting today, Wednesday. Tunisia's Club Africains and Algeria's GS Petrolia are the defending champions in the men's and women's contests, respectively. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's First Lady Margaret Kenyatta resumes training at the world-famous High Altitude Training Center in Iten, North Rift Valley Province in western Kenya. Today, Wednesday, Kenyatta aims to use her London Marathon appearance on the 13th of April to raise funds for maternity health care in Kenya's 47 counties. A fortnight ago, she completed the inaugural First Ladies Half Marathon in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Kenyatta and Rachel Ruto, the vice president's wife, are trained by former world marathon champion Douglas Wakihuri.
Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark.
VOA! I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America! And in tennis, British number one Andy Murray and his coach Ivan Lendl have agreed to end their two-year partnership. Under Lendl, Murray won his maiden Grand Slam title and Olympic gold in 2012 and then won the Wimbledon in 2013. According to media reports, Murray, who is currently in Miami to defend his title at the Masters Series event, said he plans to take time before considering his next step. Lendl, an eight-time Grand Slam champion, was appointed Murray's coach in December 2011 with the aim of bringing the experience and knowledge that few others have, particularly in major tournaments. In the first year under Lendl's guidance, Murray defeated Novak Djokovic to win the 2012 US Open before beating Roger Federer in the final of London 2012. Murray then ended the 77-year wait for a British men's singles champion at Wimbledon the following year with victory against Novak Djokovic. Lendl, 54, is rated as one of the world's greatest players of all time, having won 94 ATP Tour titles in a 16-year career. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a charitable organization provides funding for pediatric heart surgery in Ethiopia and will visit a restaurant in Washington, D.C. that is known as a little piece of Ethiopia. First, let's listen to some music. Here's Franco with Nostalgia.
Oh, yes. En direct de Kinshasa avec l'autre jazz. Yeah. Alors mon cher Loapo, quand on a bien mangé, bien bu, et ensuite qu'est-ce qu'on fait mon cher?
Oui mon cher Mangwana, c'est très simple, on danse.
On danse avec la musique.
On danse avec le tout puissant Okeja.
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 Du grand maître Loapo Magiadi.
Exactement.
Yeah, attaquez. Ata balobi pamba e, gaina la dananye.
problème ya ndako na ngai etalise ngai moko bozwa na ngai na kokelela ezali ya fel privé peuple y compta musique yo y compta pas palabre ngai na oke jazz ezali lisano anga bangwa na e
Mangwa na leki ton bongisa Bayaya babina Biso toluka kakaninyo Mosolo e konta Tika kolanda balo bakie Makambo etali bango Etali biso te bandeko Tika biso to sala Bamesana kaka koloba Bako suka kaka koloba Bako sala kaka koloba Etali biso te o Landa mosala kota la simate Bimisa mongongo
Nga ekutu yangane Kana kipaka telo amboe Ata balo bipambae Toluka sedimie Pa problemi ya moto na moto Etali seye moko Pozu wana yeto kokele la Ezali ya fete piveo Yali ni babo manga yo lwapoe Peuple y konta mizikyo Y konta pa palabre Ngaina oke jazz Ezali seli sanoe Tobo ngisa mizik ya mbokae Progre na miso mokoe Anga mangwa nae Emezali mabe mingyo Yaya Kayo na kufa pambae Odongoe
Frank with nostalgia. Well, each year, 1 million babies are born with congenital heart defects. 10% of them do not live to see their first birthday due to lack of treatment, most of them in poor and developing countries. But an Israel-based organization is working to improve the survival rate of those children. Mariama Diallo reports on the group's plans to train Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon and its efforts to raise money for a boy named Elias.
Since its creation in 1995, the organization Save a Child's Heart has been improving the quality of cardiac care for children in developing countries who suffer from heart disease. For the cost of $10,000, children are brought to Israel's Wolfson Medical Center to get the surgeries they need. Save a Child's Heart Executive Director David Litwack says their team of volunteers helps reduce the cost.
One of these operations in the United States could cost anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000, but for us it winds up being $10,000, and then regardless of how many surgeries they have to have, or how long they're in the hospital, or how complicated the case is, room and board in a children's home that we built 2 years ago for the child and his or her mother.
But the organization says its ultimate goal is to enable countries to treat their own children.
We made the commitment to do at least 50 children a year from Ethiopia. Equally important is that we have begun training what will be Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon.
Recently, the medical group also trained Tanzania's first cardiac surgeon, a process that took 5 years. While 40% of the kids come from Africa, Save a Child's Heart has treated children from 48 different countries, including Eastern Europe, Asia, South America, and the Palestinian Authority. Save a Child's Heart's youth branch chairman in the United States is Michael Brown.
Just this last year, we started bringing children from Haiti, from El Salvador, from Peru, and in fact, this past summer, we started bringing children from Syria. So what this shows you is that we'll go wherever the need is.
Fundraisers and volunteer coordinators make miracles possible for the medical group. This fundraising event in Washington, which Brown helped to organize, is for a special boy.
The goal of tonight is to raise $10,000 to save the life of a young Ethiopian boy named Elias for the surgery that he needs to save his life.
Elias is 15 years old and one of 26 children who are being treated right now in Israel. The event raised more than $10,000, and Elias is among the more than 3,300 children the group has treated in the last decade. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Thank you, Mariama. And for more on our feature series, log on to our website at www.voaafrica.com. By far the largest concentration of Ethiopians in America live in the Washington, D.C. area, over a quarter million. Many have opened restaurants, including one in Northwest Washington called the Queen of Sheba. VOA's Paul Sisko met the successful owner and manager of this little piece of Ethiopia in the United States and has this story.
Nikisti Gebreyesus is the queen. At the center of what some consider Little Ethiopia in Northwest Washington, D.C., is the Queen of Sheba restaurant, owned and operated by the Queen and her husband, Mbasa Mesigina.
You have to love the job. You have to like everything about it, the long hours, the demand. It could be slow, it could be busy. You have to prepare yourself.
I was recently invited for coffee. Mm-hmm.
Coffee is very important for us. It's our tradition to welcome guests by doing this kind of ceremony.
The Queen was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sudan, spent time in Canada, and now calls Washington, D.C. home.
I hope one day we are able to come to Ethiopia and expand our business.
The successful restaurant is something of a family affair. She runs it with her husband, a cousin, and a niece, a Spanish cook.
And daughter, Marta, on vacations from college, helps in the almost always busy kitchen.
No, it's too much.
So this is a split peas. This is red lentils, green lentils, color green, and cabbage.
That's where I got my first taste of a very special dish.
Mm.
All the food at the Queen of Sheba's is organic, traditional, and fresh.
You only can find this food here.
Many ingredients are flown in every day from Ethiopia.
And people keep coming again and again because it's authentic food and fresh. It's different and it's very healthy. people love it. And we love it that they love it too, so, you know, we can be in business for a long time.
The restaurant is a warm, friendly gathering place for conversation and much more. From noon to early morning, customers and friends and new friends eat, drink, visit, and enjoy at a pace much more Ethiopian than American. The restaurant is a little piece of Ethiopia in Washington, D.C.
Oh, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
I couldn't leave without promising the Queen I'd be returning.
You're welcome. Thank you. Want a taste?
Well, I have, and I can assure you I'll be back at the Queen of Sheba's again soon. Paul Sisko, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the greatest crimes perpetrated by the Assad regime against the people of Syria is the damage it has inflicted on children. 3 years into the conflict, some 10,000 children have been killed and thousands more wounded and disabled by the violence, with the rest in danger of becoming a lost generation. 1,200,000 Syrian children have been forced to flee the country and seek refuge in neighboring countries. At the same time, 3 million children inside Syria are out of school. In both cases, many are homeless, destitute, uprooted from their familiar surroundings, and have been witness to the brutality of war. Of the 9.3 million people that are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance in Syria, 5.5 million are children, more than twice as many as last year. Thousands of children from Syria are working to help support their families. Girls have been forced into early marriage. Boys, many of them barely into their teens, have been recruited to support the fighting. Syria cannot afford to lose its children. Compromising the future of their children means compromising the future of the country. To help avert this crisis, the United States government has joined UNICEF, UNHCR, Save the Children, World Vision, and other aid agencies and NGOs in the No Lost Generation Initiative, which addresses the immediate and long-term impacts of the Syria crisis on a generation of children and youth in Syria and the Near East region. The No Lost Generation Initiative calls for robust support from the international community to provide protection from exploitation, abuse, and violence, and psychological care for trauma-affected children and youth both inside Syria and in the region. These programs include strengthening host government and community-based child protection systems, which respond to the needs of girls, boys and families at high risk of abuse, neglect, exploitation, and violence, while protecting all children against such risks. The initiative will also scale up access to quality education for refugee children who have fled Syria and for school-aged children who remain inside the country. Programs supported through the initiative will provide remedial education and psychological support organized in school clubs for preschoolers and out-of-school children. The United States stands with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, when he states that without these urgent investments, millions of Syrian children may never recover from so much loss and fear. Their future and the future of their nation is at stake.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.